Well, as I was saying, I think Franklin Roosevelt's great skill was not only communication, which our incumbent is elected to have, but also a sense of communicate for what and how to do it, and there's a sense of the appropriate time in which you allow things you want to do to almost come to you as a popular demand. There was a consensus that the good opinion was formed. And that's, I think, what Lawrence was good at. And it's what Roosevelt, I think, was a master of. And which is to say, I feel the Carter administration wholly lacked.
During these years, Mr. Rob, did you have the opportunity to attend any National Democratic Convention?
No, I never was at a Democratic Convention because I always stayed home to mind the store.
I see. Due to your wife's assignment with David Lawrence in the Kennedy administration, did either of you have any contact with the Kennedy or members of their administration?
Well, Rita did because, as I say, she was working out of the executive office. But I was in India at that time. We were not yet married. And I only met President Kennedy, I suppose, once or twice when he was campaigning. And once when we came to the White House to have this Delaware Basin Compact signed, that I still had his signature together with Nelson Rockefeller and Mayor Wagner, Mayor Dilworth, and the other assorted dignitaries up here. And it's my best autograph, I guess. I'll leave it to somebody. No, I never had a direct personal contact with Kennedy. I was offered a job in the Kennedy administration when I was in Philadelphia, but I couldn't see the point of leaving what I was doing in Philadelphia to accept that. And but I was, I'd been an early Kennedy supporter, and in fact I was for him before Mayor Lawrence was.
Did you change Lawrence's mind?
Partly. Lawrence was a great admirer, probably so, of Adlai Stevenson. And he sort of hoped he gets hope that somehow Stevenson would be the nominee. I felt that was not going to be realistic. And that we would have to take Kennedy, and the sooner we took him, the better. So, I mean, that led anyhow. But Lawrence's sense of timing was the right one on that, because it turned out that the Pennsylvania delegation was the decisive delegation in the Los Angeles Convention. He was very good at that, too. He always knew when to throw in the state's weight in the Democratic Party.
I'm trying to recall, did Lawrence stay on after the Kennedy administration?
Briefly, I think. I think he stayed in the Johnson administration. Now, my wife resigned, I think, and came home to live with her family here in Pittsburgh. Then she came up to meet me in Kenya. We were married in Kenya in 1968.
According to your visa from 63 to 73, you were with the Ford Foundation. How were you directed to the Ford Foundation?
Well,
that's quite a switch from government assignments in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Well, actually, pure accident. And it is one of the strange things that most of the things that happened in my life have been an offshoot, really. I've never sat down and say, in 1981, I hope to do this, in 1984, I'll be this, and so on. And that, none of it has happened that way. Why, I went to India because I met by accident in a revolving door at the Sheraton Hotel in Philadelphia, a man named Paul Ilvesacker. That's Y. Ilvesacker. Y-L-V-I-S-A-K-E-R. Who was an official of the Ford Foundation, which at that time was really the height of its glory. I'd known Paul in Philadelphia because he had been with Joe Clark when Clark was mayor of Philadelphia. And I'd known him again in this Delaware Basin negotiation in which we'd had a Ford grant. And so Paul and I stayed outside of the, went outside the hotel. I was going to take a taxi to go home. We talked a little bit. And we exchanged, what are you doing, what are you doing? And Paul said, I'm looking for somebody to take our assignment in Calcutta. And I knew they had a budget in Calcutta, I just vaguely knew about it. I said, gee, Paul, that'd be interesting. If you have something in Paris, why don't you let me know? But we talked a little further. I did say to him what had been in my mind, that I had not had an opportunity to share in the overseas experience that so many professional Americans were having during this time of the American century, of that period. And Paul sort of thought about it. 2 days later, he called me and said, "I've mentioned your name at the foundation. There's a great excitement up here. Would you be willing to talk to us about going to Calcutta?" So I said, "Well, anybody that doesn't talk to a Ford Foundation, I'm very foolish, so I'll talk to you." And I was at a pivotal point in Philadelphia. I'd done 6 years there. And I had to make a decision. If I didn't make a change at that particular juncture, I would have been committed to another set of projects to which I would have had to remain faithful until they were accomplished. So it was really a question. This would be now or never, more or less, of making a change. And I'd always had a great desire to see all of the world. And particularly India had always fascinated me through reading. Was already bitten by Rudyard Kipling, I think. And in a few weeks, I really agreed to take the Calcutta assignment as chief consultant to what was called the Calcutta Metropolitan Planning Organization. And the reason they wanted me was that I'd had experience in urban development programs in the United States. They were optimistically hopeful that somehow some of those things could be applied in another environment, for a different environment. A few of them really did become applicable. And they had a project which had fallen into disarray. They had spent a lot of money on it, but they had internal discord between both the Indians and the Ford people, and within the Ford group itself, and a collapse of leadership, really. So I had the responsibility of taking over a very troubled project. And I was grateful for the opportunity. I also felt that it would be to my personal advantage to be with the foundation, because the foundations then, not so much now, had a good habit from one's point of view. Once they took you, they sort of became responsible for you. They adopted you. And I was a point of life where, again, someplace I would have to make a reason, where do I finally end up? And so I took it and went to India with this Calcutta assignment and remained there for 4 years until we were able to actually complete the Calcutta Metropolitan Plan and put the organization on what seemed to be an appropriate basis and give the foundation a sense that its money had not been wasted and the project finally achieved a degree of credibility.
What was actually
it? Well, Calcutta is an enormous aggregation of people. 8 million or 14 million, whichever way you want to count the area, very poor, with a steady decline in public services, a great deal of civic turbulence as well, and with problems so acute it's very hard for anybody sitting in America to even imagine them. All the problems really are how do you handle a mix of an extremely primitive poverty level society with an objective to also have that same society adapt itself to reasonable technology, industrial production, the management of moving several million people back and forth within the district to their jobs each day, basic primitive standards of public health, how do you try to get a decent water supply that won't give everybody a constant dysentery, how do you deal with the general, with transportation, the bridges, the roads, the water supply, the land uses. How primitive can you, what's the degree of housing you can afford in such a society? And things of that, issues of that kind. And how do you organize the state and local governments and the national government in some relationship to maintain these? And what is their relationship? At that time, very active and still with organizations like the World Bank and the World Health Organization and various other and the USAID program. And so those were the issues with which we dealt. And so I don't think that it's hard to say whether Calcutta would be any different now or today if we had never been there. I'm told, however, that some of the things we proposed have actually been carried out. And the main contribution I think I made intellectually, which your predecessors had not been able to come to grips with, was that you couldn't attempt in that society to have an elaborate housing program. We can't run public housing in this country. So you can imagine what a public housing community would be in India. And but the resources, of course, not there even to provide them or to maintain them. So the conclusion we came to was that the best we could do was to, society could do, was to recognize the fact that most people in India would, for this lifetime, live in relatively primitive shelter accommodations. But you could help them a great deal by bringing a safe water supply, electric power, so you light the drainage so they don't live in a swamp, and these minimal environmental actions. So we created something which became known as the Busti, that's B-U-S-T-E-E, Busti meaning a slummer area in India, or a self-created area, I should say. Busti Improvement Program, and a number of major projects, also bridges and other things that we financed from abroad. And so I'm told, as I say, I left India just after the plan was published. I've only been back once, not too long ago to know. I'm told that many of the things we proposed have actually been carried out, and there is a water authority, a Busti Improvement Authority, and these things were in the Hooghly Bridge Authority, and these things which we proposed have actually been achieved. I'm also told that they're trying to build a subway, which scares the life out of them. And they have 100,000 people sleeping in it. But at any rate, so I feel that what I did in India was to meet my obligations both to the foundation and to the company, the job, to Bengal City.
Is the Ford Foundation still involved
there? They still have an office in India, but I don't think they have anyone left in Calcutta.
Were these Nehru years?
Nehru died while I was in India. He was succeeded by Shastri, and who was succeeded by Mrs. Gandhi.
I see.
But I only met Nehru once. And,
do you have any impressions of him that you could share with us?
I have no really basic evidence. It has to be a historical evaluation. And of course, obviously, he was idolized in India. It had been sort of the cement in which an independent country had formed itself. It's a country, India is a country where when you're there, you say, well, all these people here, they have to make it somehow. When you go away, you say, how can they? So it's, but I greatly enjoyed the opportunity. I was very grateful to the foundation for having extended it to me. At any rate, I told them at the end of my fourth year that that was enough. I was going to go back to the States or do whatever. And they offered me instead an assignment, rather different in their own organization. I've been what's called a project specialist, which is somebody on a contract to work for so many years in this specific assignment. They offered a choice to become a foundation representative, which meant, in effect, the head of all the foundation activities within a certain region. And they offered me a choice of East and Central Africa or Thailand. And I chose East and Central Africa.
Could I interrupt you
sure.
just a moment? To get back to India, did you take staff along with you?
Oh yes, we recruited at various times. There must have been 20 expatriate people from the United States, Canada, Australia, Poland, UK, United Kingdom. We had an international staff, and as I say, we ran usually about 20 people or more. It was usually too many, actually, and it's a difficult thing to recruit people for overseas assignment. You interview them, you look at their CV, you have to make up your judgment very quickly. And when you get them over there, you're stuck with them for 2 years.
That's true.
Or 4 years, and sometimes they're very good, and sometimes they're disappointing.
What about a local staff? Did you?
Oh yeah, well, the local staff was a very large one, as most agents in India are. There are several hundred people in there.
Were these primarily Ford people or government people?
No, well, the Ford people were the people of our own. The other people were Indian government people working for the state of West Bengal. Calcutta is in West Bengal, and the major metropolitan functions are really in the state rather than in the city government, which is never been struck.
Were you at all involved with the family planning that was Planned Parenthood and stuff
not.
Like that was
the,
going
the,
on at that
the
time?
The Ford Foundation had a very active program administered out of Delhi. It had very active programs in family planning and in agriculture and in block community development in the rural areas. Those were its major. Ours was sort of an eccentric eccentricity in the General Ford Foundation program, which the Ford representative in India had decided to do because of what he thought was a particularly dangerous urban condition that some remedy should be found, for which some remedy should be found. But those programs were nationwide and administered from the representative's office in New Delhi.
Was your family with you in India?
My then wife and daughter came out, my son did not, and in the life in the last several years.
What was the attitude towards Americans?
Well, a mix, I think, on that. I think we got along very well with our Indian colleagues. The left-wing people, some of the intellectuals and professional left-wing press, and others, of course, were always saying it. The CIA or you were imperialist, all the other things you expect them to say. Generally speaking, I think. Also, we were a little difficult to say because we were bringing a good deal of money into India. We were providing scholarships and very enviable things by Indian standards to people, so you couldn't be absolutely sure that you were being, I've always said that people are very nice at the foundation executives, and they never know whether anybody loves you for yourself, because there's always some hope that something good could follow. Well, no, at the time we were there, Chester Bowles was the American ambassador for the most part, very popular in India. The Kennedy administration was very popular, as it was throughout the developing countries. And so it was a really sort of a high tide period of Americans. Both the receptivity of others for American assistance, and pretty much a pretty general acceptance, yes.
And you say that you gave a lot of scholarships and that kind of money. There are a number of Indians that study in the United States and become too overqualified really to go back. Was there any attempt to guide them into areas that the state, that India itself really needed?
Well, that was always the thought, of course. But the human nature is such that when people are taken out of a society where they're living in a very low material level and given the opportunity to take the same skills and bring them to another society, whether it's the Arab Emirates on the Gulf or whether it's the United States, a good many of the professional class in India finds that they're better off, obviously, working abroad. And many do not. The attempt, of course, always was, and the belief always was, that the people you helped educate abroad would come back and contribute to their own society. But you couldn't indenture them to the fact that they had to do that. And many educated Indians have gone into the international organizations, again, for the benefits that they get from international service in the UN or the UN-related organizations, as against what they would get at home. In fact, the present chief officer, I think, on urban affairs in the World Bank was one of our people from Calcutta. And that's not unusual.
Do you have any reactions on the UN and how it actually functions in its...
Well, I think the UN, frankly, is degenerated. But from its original founding, which was based really on a limited number of countries and a pretty reasonable balance between East and West and North and South, now become so overwhelmingly dominated by the third world countries that it's developed its own politics and its own irrationalities. And I don't think a hell of a lot of it.
In India, did you have any contact at all with Jewish population?
No, I did not. There are very few Jews in India. There's a small colony of they call white Jews in Cochin, southern India, and a larger colony of black Jews, what they call black Jews there. And I never worked in that part of India, which is in the extreme south. In Calcutta, to my knowledge, I didn't meet any. We had, of course, a number of Jews in our Ford Foundation team, yeah. But anyway, no Indian-born Jews, to my knowledge, although I think there was a synagogue in Calcutta, and one of our men, Al Jacobs, who is now at the University of California, I think did some research on the Jewish communities in India.
Do you have any knowledge of their living conditions attitudes?
No, I do not. No, as I say, the only Jews who would be Indian born for a generation or more would be these little colonies down in the south. I think after the Hitler period, or during the Hitler period, a number of Jews came to India as in the diaspora that occurred, and probably got professional jobs, things of that sort around the country, but not because of their Judaism, simply because of their adaptation to a skill. How many actually live in India to this day, I don't know.
You know, but you're not aware of any government attitudes.
Well, the government of India is anti-Zionist. They've never recognized Israel. And so as far as the international situation is concerned, they've always been pro-Arab and anti-Israel. As far as locally, there'd be no discrimination whatsoever. I mean, you're a Christian or a Jew, or you're a European, you're not a Christian or a Jew or whatever. Be as far as I could tell, I believe.
Well, now we'll come to East and Central Africa. You'll tell us about how you happen to be directed there.
Well, that again is one of these accidents that happened to me. First, of course, I was with the foundation. Second, of course, the job happened to come open. And third, I had taken a long leave from India to travel at my own pace, my own expense.
In India?
In East Africa.
Oh, I see.
Which wasn't very far. And I naturally stopped in to see the Ford Foundation people when I arrived in Nairobi. Then they didn't see much of me later until I came back from a very long safari. And at any rate, it seemed to have made some impression on them that I had a special interest in Africa and its problems. And since they had determined, apparently, to recruit me as a representative, they mentioned the jobs which were open, which happened to be the East Africa job and the Thailand job. And I had fallen in love with East Africa, as I think most people do who see it. And it didn't take me very long to decide that. In addition to that, no other reason, also the Vietnam War was in progress, and I had no desire to be in Thailand, which would be, very early on, I reached the conclusion we were in a disaster course in Vietnam. And strangely enough, my own experience in Calcutta about showed me that. I wondered why the American government was so stupid. We were trying to run a planning organization with foreign advisors, and we had a very difficult time doing that. And very often it would mean that you would be drawn more and more into having to do the work yourself or take responsibility for yourself. And I knew very well if you can't run a planning organization that way, you can't run a war. So I had great skepticism from the beginning of our involvement in Vietnam. But to have gone to Thailand, I would obviously become involved in Southeast Asia at that time, and I had no desire to do that. So I was very fortunate to get 3 years that I got in Kenya.
The aim here, I believe, was to initiate and execute the foundation's program of technical assistance and grant action.
Yeah, that's the official statement.
Now, what is the unofficial statement?
The unofficial statement. I had a great time taking people around to show them all the wonderful day parts. Actually, it's not a pressing job in many ways, but an interesting one. But unlike my other assignments, I found a program already in place. And one of my jobs simply was to carry on what my predecessor had done. Essentially, the representative's job is administrative. And my particular interest, of course, being what they were, I was personally much interested in the program the foundation had in ecology and environmental conservation and the great nature reserves such as the Serengeti, the other national parks of Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda.
But what was the principal focus of the program?
Well, principal focus, again, in an international program, threefold, I think. One was to supply experts recruited on a worldwide basis to the planning ministries and financial ministries and educational ministries of the newly independent countries. Remember when this was early 1970, and Kenya had been independent only for 8 years, Tanzania for 9 years, Uganda for 7 years. So they still have a need for expatriate people in the, sort of the heart of government, actually, to keep running. And they were an attempt, really, to advise them on economic planning and development. So also, university grants, money grants to university. Well, Ethiopia, we had a major program at Haile Selassie University, Addis Ababa, and in Dryas University, and intellectual scholarship grants in all the countries. Economic development to certain public corporations. Again, our major program there was one, supplying expertise to foreign advisors whom we financed, recruited and financed, and making institutional grants to universities and research institutions, others that seemed to be deserving, and with especially large, well, at least an important set of grants to the Serengeti Research Institution, which a man named John Owen headed. Serengeti's become world famous, of course, in a given time. The grant I look at, in retrospect, with great satisfaction, is that I made a small grant within my own discretion to Richard Leakey when he was only 22 years old to get him started. The Ford Foundation really had an interest in what Richard has been able to accomplish, which is a great deal. But it was a generalized program, and typical foundation activities.
Lynn, you feel it was effective?
I think it was effective. I think that, as I said, this is the foundation. If we had never been there, nothing would be much different. But that's part of the business. And the risk you have, of course, in the much of the developing world, particularly in Africa, is that the people you help train and the governments with whom you work are overthrown. People are killed, exiled, whatever, and you get a wholly unstable situation, such as you have in Uganda and in Ethiopia. Obviously, whatever we did in Uganda or Ethiopia long since has gone down the drain. Unfortunately, you know, Uganda had the best university in the area. So, I mean, it really turns out to be almost like a spawning of a herring. They lay about 2 million eggs in one hatchet.
And you were married in Kenya?
Yes.
Your wife joined you there?
Yeah.
I see.
We got married on Independence Day, which is not a holiday.
Happy for you. Yeah,
I think it is.